Hello, everybody, and welcome to the American Shoreline Podcast. This is Peter Ravella, the co-host of the show.
And this is Tyler Buckingham, the other co-host.
Tyler, last show we had on Derek Brockbank, the executive director of the Coastal States Organization, and we're talking a lot about the incredible amount of federal funding that is flowing to the American shoreline in a variety of different programs from various federal agencies. And it has been clear in following that trend that there is a substantial new investment opportunity for tribal organizations around the country, and particularly on the American shoreline. And we learn more and more, Tyler, about a desire to integrate Native American thinking and conservation ethics into shoreline management. And we thought we would take a special opportunity to discuss this, the role that tribes have historically played on the American shoreline. And I'm just really interested in this topic, and I think we have a chance to learn a lot today with a great guest on the show.
We really do. And, you know, Peter, as a millennial, as the resident millennial, I'll say there's a vibe right now. There's a vibe in on the American shoreline that tribal knowledge is intuitively like we lost something and we need, and it's like it's back there. And tribal knowledge is a way to maybe unlock a better way to relate with our planet. And on the American shoreline, it's there's no exception. I recall the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary here in Southern California. It's clear that along the West Coast here, there are several stories. Peter, you were talking earlier in our show prep about some of the dam removal projects that are happening. I mean, these are like cutting, this is the cutting edge. This is the state of the art, and it's all happening. And there's a lot of tribal influence there. So I'm excited today, Peter, to get to learn a little bit about the history, a little bit about how we got here.
Yes. Joining us today on the American Shoreline Podcast is the chairman of the Nisqually Tribe, Willie Frank III. He is a Nisqually tribal member. He has been a member of the tribal council since 2009 when he was elected at the age of 27. He now serves, as I said, as tribal chairman. His father is an incredibly famous Native American activist, Billy Frank Jr. His father is the namesake of the Billy Frank Jr. National Wildlife Refuge here in Olympia, Washington. He is a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom given by President Obama. There will be a statue of Billy Frank in the Statuary Hall at the United States Capitol that is currently under development. Our guest today comes from a legacy of tribal activism and is the chairman of a tribe that is an active and leading participant in natural resource and fisheries management in the Puget Sound area. And I think it's going to be a great conversation to learn about the role of the tribes around the country on coastal management and fisheries management in particular. It's going to be a great show, Tyler.
I can't wait to get into this one, Peter. There's just so much history here that I don't know yet, and I'm really looking forward to diving in. But first, let's have a quick word from our sponsors.
Support for the American Shoreline Podcast Network and Coastal News Today comes from Geodynamics, an NV5 company. Geodynamics' team of specialists provide accurate surveys of complex coastal environments around the world using the latest technology in marine geology, coastal science, and remote sensing. With customized vessels and sensor configurations, Geodynamics delivers meticulous data products to answer their clients' toughest questions. Visit nv5geospatial.com or geodynamicsgroup.com to learn more about Geodynamics and their solutions that improve lives. And from the Coastal Zone Foundation. The Certified Coastal Practitioner Program from the Coastal Zone Foundation offers courses covering 11 different subject areas, including coastal engineering, ecology, geology, project management, and more. the CCP program emphasizes a multidisciplinary approach to coastal zone management, setting you apart from the competition and demonstrating your commitment to best practices and a code of ethics in your field. With modules available online or as live short courses, the CCP program is accessible to coastal professionals at all stages of their careers. Learn more at coastalzonefoundation.org. And don't forget, subscribe to the CNT Daily Blast newsletter for the latest news and updates from around the American shoreline. Want to support our work? Learn more about sponsorship packages at coastalnewstoday.com/advertising.
Well, Chairman Frank, welcome to the American Shoreline Podcast, and we really appreciate the chance to learn from you about the history of the Nisqually tribe and its role in conservation and fisheries management in Northwest. Thank you so much for the time.
Yeah, thank you guys both. I'm really honored to be here. And my name is Willie Frank III. My Indian name is Kwalashkid, and chairman of the Nisqually tribe. I had the opportunity to meet you a few weeks ago at the Nisqually Land Trust event. And you guys just... guys are interesting folks and sound like good allies to our tribe here.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it was an honor to meet you at the Nisqually Land Trust friendraiser. It was, which happened at the Nisqually Tribe Community Center. It was a real privilege to meet you. I knew that there was a great conversation to be had. So I think I'd like to start, Willie, if you don't mind, at the beginning. Tell us about the history of your tribe, and in particular, your family history in the Nisqually tribe.
Yeah, thank you. And so the Nisqually tribe, we're located about 60 miles south of Seattle. We're a part of the Medicine Creek Treaty of 1854 with Squaxin Island, Puyallup, Muckleshoot, and the Nisqually tribe. And we signed the treaty. You know, our ancestors, they had the brilliance to understand that, you know, these weren't rights that were given to us. These were reserved rights in that treaty. You know, and I think about where we are today and you know, any of that history that we teach in the schools, you know, you talk about treaties, you know, and for us, we know what our treaty means. You know, it's a supreme law of the land, you know, and our ancestors reserved those rights. Nothing was promised to us, you know, and the right to fish, hunt, and gather in our usual and the custom grounds, you know, that still is what we go off of today as Nisqually people. You know, we have such a beautiful, rich history. Chief Leshai, our chief, our last chief, you know, they said he was one of the most peaceful men when he needed to be. But at times of battle, and I don't even want to say war, because all we were doing was trying to protect our own people and our way of life. You know, and you think up to 1854 with the Medicine Creek Treaty. And then on this beautiful day, I always like to say 1879 was the day my grandfather was born, Willie Frank Sr. And he lived to be 104 years old, my grandfather. And I had the opportunity, I only knew him for a year of my life. But, you know, he was the one who kind of paved the way for our family, you know, and as well as all of our families here at Nisqually. You know, we have such a beautiful foundation of our traditional Nisqually families right now. You know, and I think about my grandfather. In 1917, two-thirds of the Nisqually reservation was taken away, condemned to make room for, which is now today, Joint Base Lewis-McChord military base. And so it was Fort Lewis back in 1917. And so two-thirds of the Nisqually reservation was taken from our people. And my grandfather at the time, we had over 250 acres of land, like our family did up on the Muck Creek Village here at Nisqually. And when that land was taken and my grandfather was bought out, he had the brilliance to purchase a piece of land next to an old wagon crossing, which is known today as Frank's Landing. And really, as we continue our story here, then, you know, it kind of ties everything that we're doing in today's time, you know, to the brilliance of our ancestors, you know, and our elders here at Nisqually to be able to set us up and put us in a position that we're in today. You know, I think about my grandfather and everybody who talked about him. They said he was, you know, just the most amazing human being in the world. He was our last fluent language speaker, you know, and now to see today, we have two of our council ladies who are language keepers, you know, and I think about just that history and, you know, the displacement, you know, and what comes with that, you know, it's that loss of identity, loss of language, loss of family, culture, you know, really, and a loss of respect for ourselves, you know, and I think about the world we live in today, you know, and I like to always remind folks that, you know, entitlement, you know, is not something that our people were taught at a young age. You know, we don't ever get taught that as Nisqually people. You know, my father was working up until 83 years old. The last day he was still putting his shoes on, ready to go to work. You know, and I think about the boarding schools. I think about our language being, you know, taken from us, our culture and everything. And we're still here today, you know, as beautiful people. And I think about throughout, you know, Nisqually's history and really once the reservation was condemned, you know, you think about that timeline. And my father, who was born in 1931, Billy Frank Jr., you know, he was arrested for the first time in his life in 1945. He was 14 years old for fishing off the reservation because the state of Washington decided to draw these nice, beautiful boundary lines that said, this is where you Indians can fish. You know, and for us, we always knew because the treaty, you know, the treaty said it, that we had the right to fish, hunt, and gather in all of our usual and accustomed areas. You know, and I like to always remind folks that the boundary lines of our reservations, those were drawn in. You know, the way we always were the managers of the resources is that, you know, when our families were hungry, we'd go catch a fish. You know, when our other sister or brother tribes were hungry or they needed something, we'd help. You know, and so getting back to kind of that traditional way of just keeping life a little bit simpler, I think is very important. You know, and you think about the world we live in and, you know, we've lost a lot of our elders in the last few years, you know, with COVID, but also even kind of before that, you know, the real teachers, you know, and now here we are today, 2023, you know, and we have this opportunity to teach folks, you know, we have opportunity to do these podcasts, you know, to educate folks about our key points of history. And so my father was arrested the first time in 1945. And, he was arrested over 50 more times after that. You know, and the last time he was arrested was 1970. And where we grew up along the Nisqually River, it's a place known as Frank's Landing. And my father, my grandfather, myself, you know, my older brother, we all grew up there. And it was where our family, we all lived there, you know. And so for us, it was our little kind of reservation, our little community. Because, you know, throughout our different reservations, our communities, you know, families had kinships. They had, you know, you had family ties, you had connections, you know. And so for us, that's where we grew up, but it was technically off the reservation. And so the state of Washington kept arresting, you know, my father, many other fishermen over and over again for exercising their treaty rights. And it really came to a breaking point, you know, in 1970. They were along the Puyallup River, and the state of Washington, the Fish and Game officers, the Washington State Patrol, they came down and, you know, they came down to witness the fishing that our people were having along the Puyallup River. And, you know, when we had those fishings, what would happen is we'd do demonstrations, but, you know, folks would end up getting arrested. They'd get tear gas. They were getting kind of the same treatment that, you know, our Indian people were getting, but it was that demonstration, that witness is, you know, bringing folks to see what happens at nighttime along the Nisqually River or along the Puyallup or, you know, our other riverways. And so 1970, it was just the famous day of kind of when they lit the bridge on fire right there in Tacoma. And for folks who haven't seen, please go to salmondefense.org and there's a link on there for the documentary, As Long as the Rivers Run. And in that documentary, it tells that history about Frank's Landing and the fishing wars. But in that documentary, that key piece, it shows, you know, everybody getting arrested, they get their heads beaten in, you know, they get maced, they get tear gassed. Well, that day, the U.S. attorney happened to be there witnessing what was going on, and he got tear gassed and he got, you know, maced. And, you know, so that kind of woke up the United States of America to start looking into what was going on with our tribes out here in the state of Washington. You know, and so 1970, we go up to 1974, Judge George Bolt is the proceeding judge over this court case, U.S. versus Washington. You know, the tribes are going to bat with the state of Washington on our treaty rights. And Judge Bolt, he was a conservative judge. He was an Eisenhower appointee. And he was really somebody who I think, you know, my father talked about. He was very, very worried about, you know, Judge Bolt overseeing this case because he wasn't sure he was going to listen. And so for me growing up, hearing these stories were so important. But now as I get older, I'm realizing how much more important they are to where we have to take it to the next level. And I think back to U.S. versus Washington, there was a point in the court proceedings, and I have this recording of my dad talking about this. And what he says is that we had a grandma from Suquamish tribe across the water here. And she was on the witness stand, and Slade Gordon, who was the attorney for the state of Washington at that time, he was talking to our grandma, and she didn't speak English. And so what happened was, you know, Judge Bolt, you know, didn't really know what to do at that time because he'd never been in a courtroom where somebody was speaking our Lushootse language. And so what our attorneys at the time did, the brilliance is they had Grandpa Willie in the courtroom, my grandfather. And Grandpa Willie started speaking to Grandma Hilaire on the, you know, on the witness stand in our language. And the state of Washington objected. They got up all bent out of arms, you know, and they said, well, they can't be speaking another language because we don't know what they're saying. Well, Judge Bolt overruled that. Judge Bolt allowed for our Nisqually language to be heard in the courtroom in 1974. You know, and I think about that because it's taken almost 50 years for it to come back and awaken at Nisqually again. You know, and I think about the significance of that with everything that, you know, our people have gone through, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and we're still here today. You know, and I think about Judge Bolt, what he went through. He was, you know, tarred and feathered for doing the right thing. And it just so happened yesterday, I actually had lunch with Bill Wilkerson. And Bill was the former Washington State Fish and Wildlife Director in the early 80s who actually started co-management with my father. And Bill Wilkerson is working on a book of the history of kind of the fishing wars and the Bolt decision. And so it was really kind of, and then of course we worked out with you guys today, you know, it kind of, everything's lining up in such a unique way because now you have 1974, the Bolt decision comes out, they rule in favor of the tribes. 1979, the Washington State, you know, Slade Gordon and his crew, they tried to, you know, challenge it at the Supreme Court and they lost. You know, and I think about the time period because I was born in 1982. And so for me, I was very fortunate in my life to grow up not with my dad, seeing my dad, you know, drink and getting the hell beat out of him for exercising his treaty rights. So I could be here today to have an opportunity to talk to you guys. You know, and I think about that government to government relationship, you know, the relationship right now Nisqually has, I think just with the local schools, the, you know, when you think about the protection of from the summit to the sea. You know, we manage 90 miles from Mount Rainier to the mouth of the Nisqually River, out into the Puget Sound, and then out into the Salish Sea. You know, and I think about that because, you know, once we can get our people to start understanding that, you know, we have to leave this place a better place, you know, for the next seven generations out. You know, and for me, it's about being able to try to educate folks, not just on our Nisqually history, but I think about how we have to share this co-management with the state of Washington right now. You know, and you think about most of our tribes are hampered down with Public Law 280. You know, and that was created back in the, you know, they put that in place in the 1950s when tribes didn't have the resources. You know, and it wasn't a bad thing. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But I think now our tribes are getting to the strength of, you know, being able to really govern and sovereign our own selves, protect our homelands. But also, that doesn't mean we don't work with the local counties and the cities or the local jurisdictions. But I think we're at a place in time now where people are ready to come to the table and learn about the tribe, but also, you know, ask the tribe for help if they need to. You know, for prime example, today we just met with our newly elected county sheriff here in Thurston County, Sheriff Sanders, you know, and talking about building relationships, you know, to protect a lot of our homelands, you know, because we are a checkerboard reservation also.
Willie, I'd love to just have you talk a little bit about the Nisqually tradition with the water. Like, what connects culturally Nisqually people with the water?
Well, so in our language, Tokolma, that means don't forget the water. And so, like I was talking about with our language right now, you know, I'm working really on teaching a generation of young kids what it means to be a fisherman, what it means to, you know, hang your net, what it means to be on that river, you know, respecting the river, not being afraid of it, but you have to show it respect. And so for me, being on that water, you know, growing up hearing the story of the mountain, you know, Mount Rainier or Mount Tahoma, you know, and for us, Tokolma means don't forget the water. And so in 2016, we hosted the Paddleton Nisqually. And for all you listeners, we're hosting 2026 again. Nisqually Tribe is hosting the canoe journey. And so everybody is invited for that in 2026. But I think for us, the water is so sacred and unique. It's really, you know, one of the four foundational pillars I always like to talk about for tribes. Because you have water, you know, you have your trees, you know, and you think about the mountain, you know, and then you think about the land, you know, as tribes. And those are the four things we really try to protect, you know, and it's funny you ask about the water, because I'm trying to get our younger generation to kind of slow down a little bit in this world that we live in, you know, and taking them, getting them on the water. And then we get down to the river and we're just sitting there. Nobody's saying anything. We're just kind of looking at the water. And then they're like, well, what do we do now? And I always laugh. I'm like, you don't do anything. You just make sure this water's still flowing every day. You know, you reassure that, you know, everything, the state, the military base who owns, you know, who has half of the reservation still, and they're on the other side of the river, that they're not driving tanks through this water, that they're assuring that our habitat and our salmon streams where they spawn are able to get up there, you know, where there's nothing blocking them off. You know, there's no riparian zones that are being destroyed. I think for me, I always like to tell folks, you know, on Sundays when we used to fish every Sunday, now we only fish 12 days a week or 12 days a year. I mean, so we used to fish, you know, 5-6 months out of the year, and now we're down to 12 days. But every Sunday when that river's open and we're on the river, I always like to tell folks that's my church. You know, something about that water, something about that river, whether we catch one fish or we catch 100, you know, it's something that my dad, my grandpa, my brother, and I all still share, because my brother and I still are fishing. You know, and I think about that. Without clean, healthy water, those salmon aren't going to be coming down the river, up the river, you know, being able to spawn so we can have life with the salmon. You know, and I think about just the connection. It's not just the water. We're connected to everything that connects the water to the mountain, to the trees, to, you know, our salmon, to our resources, I think.
It's an amazing story. And for the benefit of the listeners out there, to just fill in some of the detail, on the 1854 Treaty of Medicine Creek was between, this is pre-Washington State as a state, was it not?
Yes. So this was a treaty that we have with the United States government. Mm-hmm. And it is a supreme law, the land, that treaty, when our ancestors signed it in 1854.
Yep.
You know, and there's always question about who really did sign the treaty, even.
Well, it's an interesting story, because the treaty was with multiple tribes, including the Nisqually, and it, as you mentioned, ensured that the native communities would be able to fish in their usual and accustomed places, and guaranteed the tribes that right in perpetuity. However, of course, as we all know a little bit about American history, the United States didn't uphold those treaty obligations that it had made to the tribes, and the state of Washington was actively enforcing fishing regulations against the tribes and against tribal fishermen and arresting them. And of course, this is where your father became such an instrumental player as a young man at age 14 and ends up committing his life essentially to the reestablishment of the tribe's fishing, traditional fishing rights, culminating, as you said, in the Bolt decision. And Willie, when I was in law school at Lewis and Clark Law School in the 1980s in environmental law, this particular case was central to the education that I received in environmental law in the Pacific Northwest, where the federal judge ruled, as you said, that the treaty is the supreme law of the land and that the state of Washington was prohibited from preventing the tribes from fishing in their usual and customary grounds and in their usual customary ways. It's a remarkable history that shows both the commitment of the tribal community to the resources and the relationship with the land, but also the willingness to fight in the legal system to establish the tribal rights that are so important today. So I really, really love that story. And what's amazing today, Willie, that from my perspective in watching what's happening, is this greater emphasis these days, it seems, openness to working with tribes on real management decisions where the tribes are not sort of being asked, well, what do you think, that the tribes have actual power and actual regulatory authority and are full partners in the management of coastal resources. Can you talk about how sophisticated it is for the tribe, which does manage resources now, the capabilities required to really play this role as true co-managers of these coastal resources?
Yeah, no, I definitely can. I think, you know, Bolt, the one thing it did is it gave us that I guess the teeth back, you know, and it reassured us we knew what we were doing because we've always been resource or managers of the resources. You know, I used to hear stories all the time about, you know, there's so many fish, you know, that used to be able to walk across the river on their backs, you know, and I think about, I'm looking literally on my desk. I have a picture. I bet my dad was probably in his early 40s, I bet maybe late 30s. And he's holding this picture of a king salmon standing next to my grandpa. And this thing looks so heavy and just, I mean, now we're lucky to catch a 20 pounder. And so I think, you know, what came out of U.S. versus Washington, one, you know, one of the things my dad told me about that he always tried to get across to our people is once that decision came down, it made us co-managers with the state of Washington. And so for us, we were already managers, but now it was like, okay, they're giving us this, you know, responsibility and authority. This is what we've wanted our whole life. You know, and so that's why for us at Nisqually, everybody asks us kind of what we do and like if there's any secrets. And it's like, no, it's like being good partners. You know, it's like understanding what federal Indian law is, state law, you know, what our treaty says. But most important, U.S. versus Washington is kind of the foundational pieces, because what comes out of that now, of course, is the North of Falcon process. So we have this process every year with our co-managers. And we sit, we come in for, you know, 1, 2, 3 weeks out of the year. And we have meetings with the tribes and the state folks discussing the salmon forecast, the salmon runs in each individual watershed. And so everything that comes, I think, from that management, you know, I think we're coming into this time to realize you can't just throw money at the problem anymore. You know, you got to have good people. You got to be a good steward. You know, I think about what we do. We manage those 90 miles from Mount Rainier, as I said, to the mouth of the Nisqually River. And now I think we have close to 80% of that watershed starting to be protected. You know, it's buying land. It's you know, trusting like the Nisqually Land Trust, the Nisqually River Council, you know, building relationships on both sides of the aisle, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. You know, it doesn't matter. You try to work with everybody who has that same idea and the same cause.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about this partnership, I guess, attitude that you have? And I'm guessing the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree.
Yeah, no, no.
With regard to, yeah, for sure, working with the other players in your area here in contemporary times? I mean, you've got other fishermen for sure. You've got other pressures on the resource. I'm sure you have development pressures on land in adjacent areas to where you are. You've got the land trust where you and Peter met at that event. talk a bit about how the Nisqually Tribal Council is like knitting into the community outside of the Nisqually tribe.
Well, I kind of look at it like we're weaving it together, right? Like, I think about it. So my cousin Hanford McLeod, who was a former council member with me, you know, we talk about our family a lot and talk about that history, you know? And so for me, and we always laugh because it's like, we've been trying to tell folks that this weaves together, you know, it's like our grandma Angeline, she was a master basket weaver. And him and I used to always laugh because it's like, once we can get everybody to see how this weaves together, everything is going to work is so much better. You know, because I think about for myself and others, like I went to public school, you know, I went to North Thurston High School, which is 10 minutes from where we had where our culture center's at. And you think about it, you don't learn the history about Nisqually in our schools anymore, you know? And so for me, I graduated high school in the year 2000, and I really wanted to figure out a way to give back and be able to get back into the schools and try to help tell the story and help people, kind of not feel like the way I did of like, why don't they teach this in the schools? You know, why aren't we teaching this to a whole nother generation so we don't keep repeating history? You know, and so for me, once I kind of got old enough and I guess you could say grew up maybe and realized, you know, I mean, a lot of the time for us as younger people is like, you never want to, you know, we don't like talking about our elders like they're not there anymore. You know, and I think what I started to realize losing my father and losing so many elders so fast, I don't ever want to put a generation in this situation again where they're not going to be prepared for what's ahead. You know, and I think for me being able to come to the table and work with anybody, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, what side of the aisle you're on. If you're a good person, that's who we want to work with. You know, we want to work with good people out there. I think what we saw since 2016 is just this shift of the world and the hate, the anger, and the bitterness that's out there.
It's, you know, the legacy that your father has left, as I said, the Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge is named the Billy Frank Jr. National Wildlife Refuge after your father, and the statue where his statue will be in the United States Capitol is an extraordinary accomplishment for him as an individual and for the tribe. We're going to talk about the next generation that you're cultivating of leaders in the tribe, Willie, but I really would love to learn more about your father and, you know, fighting, being arrested at age 14 and arrested more than what I think you said more than 50 times over the course of his life to claim his rights as a Native American and under the treaty. Boy, that is a tough road to hoe. And, What kept him going? Because he was vilified up here in this part of the country and is now endeared to many people. Talk to us about your dad.
Well, you know, I think about that in the kind of the time we're in today. And, you know, what you saw with him is what you were going to get, you know, and it's that I don't know how he did it some days, you know, because I'd ask him, I'd be like, Dad, how do you do this? How do you take the hate from your own people? You know, how do you take the hate, you know, just that anger and that bitterness towards him being such a positive role model, you know, out there? And, you know, people look at that. He'd always tell me it's that crabs in a bucket theory. You know, as Indian people, we're always pulling each other back and kind of tearing each other down and trying to, you know, kind of step on each other. You know, and for me, my mother actually, you know, I don't talk about my mother a lot, but she was a Jewish woman from Detroit, and she was an attorney, and she worked for two of our governors here in the state. But she actually came to Washington to come to law school, and she was worked for Senator Magnuson at the time. And so for me, I grew up always teaching there's a better way than anger, hate, you know, jealousy. You know, it was always about community, family. You know, be respectful, you know, and like my father, he taught, I mean, women are the bosses, you know, that's the way I was raised because that's what his sister taught him, you know, and for us, you know, Grandpa Willie might've been the I guess, name of the family, but Grandma Angeline was the boss of the family, you know? And so it's like, you know, my dad, everything he taught me, because I think he was an alcoholic. He went through years of drinking, you know, he went through years of his own people kind of, you know, crapping on him, but it wasn't the fact that he didn't do it for himself. You know, he didn't do it to have a statue or a monument. He didn't do it for any of that. I mean, God dang, he probably didn't even want to do half the stuff he had to do. But he did it so I could be here today. And so we could have young leaders, you know, having a chance to tell our story today. You know, and even on the days where I'm just all frustrated as all hell, and I'm just like, what am I even doing? You know, because a lot of the time we're having to deal with fires amongst our own people, you know, who may just be kind of, may not know the history. They might be scared of the history, or they might just, I don't know what it is, you know? And so for me, it's always trying to stay as positive as we can and looking at that big picture, one within our own community. But really, I mean, I always like to tell people right now, we're that generation that grew up in the best and worst of both worlds. You know, we all went to public school, you know, we all had friends who were tribal or non-tribal within our community, you know, and now it's pretty funny to see, because I got a whole group of friends who my dad was like a second father to them, you know? And so now this statue coming full circle, it's really cool to see, you know, not just the impact on Indian country, but the impact on, you know, just this great state of Washington that he had. I think that's just so unique, because anyone who wants to sit there and they want to act entitled, or they want to sit here and say, my life's not going the way I want it to. Well, I think at the end of the day, we all have to look at ourselves in the mirrors and realize that, you know, if we're doing everything in our, you know, power to do the right thing and grow in our life, then, you know, usually good things happen. You know, and I think about my dad, who could have been bitter and angry after being thrown in jail 50 times, you know, being told, oh, you know, his education went to eighth grade. You know, one of the things I'd always ask my father growing up, you know, I'd always say, Dad, how come you never taught me the language? You know, and he'd always say, well, because we did, your grandpa didn't want us talking the language. You know, because he didn't want us, you know, he'd say that. He didn't want to, you know, same things happening, you know, getting boarding schools, you know. And so now to hear our language being awakened, and to think about my father and so many others who could have, I mean, they could have spent their life bitter and angry at the world, you know, and they didn't. And now, like we talked about at the beginning of the conversation, it really is just a good time to, you know, anybody wants to come together, you know, it's a good time right now to tell our story.
It really is. And what's so important to me as a person, and Tyler and I, you know, track issues on the American shoreline and talk to lots of people around the country about the complex management decisions that have to be made. And I have to say that I'm seeing more and more, and I don't know if it's window dressing or if it's real, but I'm starting to see a great deal more conversation about the necessity of working with the Native American community and tribes all around the American shoreline. We talked about the Klamath River Dam removal, which is being spearheaded in great part by the Klamath Tribe in Northern California. Tyler mentioned the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary in Southern California, which is being led and pushed by the Chumash Tribe, in a story similar to yours, where the current tribal chairman is the daughter of someone a little bit like, sounds like your father. When you're sitting in the chair as chairman of the Nisqually tribe and are partnering with the state of Washington and federal agencies to manage resources, do you feel like the tribe is being taken seriously as a partner? And do you can you talk about what the tribes bring to the conversation and why it's important?
Well, I do. I think now more than ever, I think we really have a chance to hold everybody accountable. You know, I think the Billy Frank Jr. Statue, you know, I think this is a way for us to let folks know we're not going to accept check the boxes anymore. You know, we're not going to accept you're going to meet with us, you're going to send your low-key staffer to meet with us. No, that's not the case anymore. You know, we want to meet with the governor, with, you know, the folks that understand what government to government is. You know, and I think we are coming to this time because, you know, it's nobody's fault, but I think a lot of our people just got comfortable over the years, I think, you know, and now it's really coming back with a new generation of leaders who are coming out, they're ready to ask those questions, you know, but it's also, you know, our people understand is that if you have somebody, you know, you have a chairman, you have leadership who are ready to, you know, push the issue on holding people accountable, you know, you can really make some progress. Because one of the most challenging things is becoming chairman was, you know, folks assumed I was some way, or they assumed I was an angry and a bitter person, and they assumed I was going to fire all these people, right? And so for me, you know, my intention coming in was to lift everybody up. You know, you try to build everybody up during this time, you know, especially coming out of COVID, it was such a challenging time. But now it's like, even at the state and the federal level, you know, people are realizing like, no, Nisqually, don't try to come out there and give them the old good old boys political line, because it's not going to work. You know, it's like we have, you know, lobbyists, we have good lobbyists, we have, you know, good, building a good team around a young council to assure we don't have those people who come out and take advantage of our tribes anymore.
On your staff, as I understand it, at the tribe, you have professional expertise within the tribal staff on resources. Can you talk about the people that you have in the tribe, or and the tribes that you work with, the Puyallup and others nearby?
That
have a high level of sophistication and resource management now. This is not informal stuff anymore. This is professionalized expertise within the tribal community.
Yeah, no, I think the change in the shift that's happened is so beautiful, because David Trout, our natural resources director, has been in here 30 plus years, 35, 36 years. And it's funny, because as a kid, I used to go to breakfast with a lot of these folks. And so I'd always, you know, go with my dad different places. And it was really funny, because now David Trout, of course, he's still our natural resources director. But when we're in meetings together, you know, I always like to tease him, David, you had black hair, you know, when you first started. And he'd say, yep. And I used to cut your pancakes up. And I'd laugh, because, you know, it's like, you know, the traditional teachings, the traditional knowledge, it's not just with our tribal folks, you know, it's with our staff too. You know, they're a part of this family. And like David talks about it all the time with my dad, you know, spending so much time with them, you know, and how much it's helped him. But now, you know, our traditional knowledge, our traditional stories, those actually are accepted now at the federal level in the North Falcon process, you know, not just for Nisqually, but some of our other tribes as well. You know, and like, we have traditional knowledge, we have traditional tools, like that show when if there's enough salmon in the river, we will fish. You know, being responsible managers of the resources, you know, we've worked on different tools and old traditional tools to come back. And so it's really cool to kind of see that knowledge, that history, you know. And it is, some of these guys, University of Washington graduates, you know, we're getting people from all over the world. You know, we always like to tell people natural resources isn't that sexy, but at the end of the day, it's what we got to protect, you know, not just for our Indian people, but, you know, all our humans.
I would love to ask this question, so I'm going to. Willie, what are your thoughts broadly on, you know, climate change as we as a collective global human society look to respond or not respond? What role do you see the Nisqually tribe playing?
Well, I think for us, we have many projects that we're working on here that, you know, affect Nisqually, the local city, town, jurisdictions. But at the end of the day, you know, we always do what's best to protect the environment and be good stewards of the land. You know, some of the projects that we're working on, I think for us, it's going to, you know, kind of pave the way. You know, this Nisqually River I-5 bridge project, you know, it's like a lot of the times with the state, you know, federal folks, we always hear their hands are tied, you know, or whatever, you know, it's kind of the political answer we get a lot of the times. And so when we hear that, you know, for me, it's always like, well, I was already told we're the ones in charge of all of this anyway. You know, that's what my dad said, you know, as a Nisqually, this is it's your responsibility to protect this land. You know, as a young kid, that's what I used to learn from him, you know. And so for me, it's like, well, if the local state, you know, local jurisdictions, whoever don't want to, you know, kind of be the bad guys, you know, I guess we'll be the bad guys. And it's not really the bad guy, because you're doing the work, you know, you're trying to protect the environment. And so, you know, for us, I think it is challenging at times, though, when, you know, you don't have folks who want to do the right thing. But at the end of the day, I think for us as tribes, and like I said, with this Billy Frank Jr. statue, I think we have an opportunity to really kind of change the narrative on climate change. You know, anything that has to do with us being able to go, you know, exercise our treaty right or go harvest our berries, harvest our, you know, camas or our traditional medicine or our traditional roots. You know, that's one of the things I love to see that's coming back, you know, is not just, you know, the language, but all of our cultural identity is coming back. And it's pretty cool to see.
It all takes money. And one of the great things you've touched on a couple of times in the conversation so far is the funders initiative, which is a $102 million commitment over the next 5 years to support indigenous-led restoration and conservation projects in the United States. It is through the Native Americans in Philanthropy and Biodiversity Funders Group. It's the Tribal Nations Conservation Pledge, but $102 million specifically for tribal conservation efforts. I think this is an important indication that not only is the respect beginning to be, you know, return to the role that the Native American community can serve in conservation, but now there are increasingly more resources. Can you talk a little bit about the funders' commitment of $102.5 million and what your tribes and other tribes in Washington State hope to accomplish?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, the Biden administration has been, you know, been amazing to Indian country and, you know, given us that opportunity, you know, to go out and really tell our story, you know, and I think that funding is going to be so valuable for, you know, not just our you know, individual tribes, but I think anybody, it's not easy telling our story. You know, we know there's a lot of emotions, there's a lot of feelings when it comes into that. You know, when we talk about our rich history, but I think now with this administration and some of the leadership you have, I think now if your tribe, your community, you know, if you guys are ready to go out and really tell your story and you have people there ready to accept that responsibility, I think this is the time to do it. And I always like to tell people right now, I mean, for what my father went through, you know, the arrests, the beatings, you know, the tear gas, all of our other, you know, Indian people throughout this great nation. And we're still here today, though. You know, we're still smiling. We're still proud. You know, our language is coming back. You know, you see Muckleshoot on the, you know, Seahawks, you know, on their jersey. You see the Muckleshoot tribe, one of our four Medicine Creek tribes, on the, you know, sponsorships to the Seattle Mariners, to the Seahawks. You know, that's progress right there. You know, and I think I hear it all the time from my folks. They're like, well, how come we're not on there yet? You know, and it's like, well, they're also right next to I-5. Better for, you know, they got a better location than we do. But that's good. I hear that from my young people. Like, we want to see our Nisqually logo on these, you know, out into the media, into the movies, into kind of just everything going on right now.
It really would be great. You know, moving to the Pacific Northwest, I just relocated here in July. Willie, and coming from the airport to Olympia, my brother-in-law, we're coming down I-5, and before we came to the house, he said, I want to stop and show you one thing before we get to Olympia, and we stopped at the Billy Frank Jr. Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge, and he was beginning to explain to me how important that particular facility is, and the history of the Nisqually River and of the Nisqually tribe and the adjoining tribes, the Medicine Creek Treaty tribes. And it coming from Texas, where there is not a vibrant recognition, I would say, of the tribal history in that state, unlike Washington state here, where the tribes, this isn't ancient history, this is current history, this is your family's history, this is still here. And to see the tribes playing an instrumental role in claiming their place at the table in this great country and serving in the capacity that you do in terms of conservation and resource management, I think is a great testament to the work that the tribes have been able to do. So it really is vibrant and real. Looking ahead, as tribal chairman, I don't know how long your term is this time or if you intend to stay.
Well, Well, I got nominations in February, and then I'll have my primary in March, and then, well, if everything goes well, I'll be reelected in May, I hope.
Great. We'll talk a little bit about, if you don't mind, before we close, what your priorities are as chairman of the Nisqually tribe.
Well, you know, I think for me, one of the priorities, one is bringing that sense of pride back to our people. You know, and it's reminding them who we are and how beautiful and how strong we are, you know, as Indian people and as Nisqually people. You know, one of the things growing up, I always like to tease people because my mother was a Jewish woman from Detroit. My father was a full-blooded Nisqually Indian who grew up right along the banks of the Nisqually River. And I know in my heart, in my life, that I cannot be anything more than a half-breed, right? And so, like, I've always been very confident with just who I am, you know, and like, you know, of course, we all grow up with insecurities, but it's like the end of the day, if we stick to our core values, you know, just of who we are and what we're taught, you know, and I always like to tell folks, you know, I had two of the most amazing parents in the world. I mean, they showed me as much love as a set of parents could show any kid, you know, and for me, realizing that not everybody grew up with that. But I believe at the end of the day, as Nisqually people, you know, we all have such a big heart, you know, and it sticks to these four, you know, kind of values. And what I've been trying to teach, you know, some of the younger folks here, you know, in Nisqually, I like to say these are our four core kind of values that we're sticking to. And it's language is one, you know, and it's not language of Lushootse. Because it's U.S. versus Washington. What does the language in there say about where we're at today? Because this really is the foundation with the treaty of where we are, you know, and how we communicate with one another. You know, it's like we've seemed like I hate to say this, but when Trump became the president, it seemed like it was okay to be racist and treat each other like crap again.
Yep.
You know, and so, you know, and then I think about, you know, how we learn from each other and teach each other, you know, but for me, you know, U.S. versus Washington is the foundational pieces for Nisqually, you know, and I talk about family and community a lot. And it's like, how do we hold our family and community accountable, respect each other? You know, one of the things I was always taught and I could never figure out, you know, why I'd have to go to these meetings with my dad and sit there all day long. Well, now I know why. So I could sit here and have a conversation with you guys about kind of what we're doing and, you know, the direction we're going in. And I think about just, for us as Indian people, I had the opportunity to go to Tulalip in April up north on the other side of Seattle when Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland came out, and it was for the boarding school initiative. You know, and my grandfather went to boarding school, you know, and so for me, it's still very, very tough topic to talk about because, you know, I'd always ask my dad growing up and it was crazy because, you know, for him, I really do feel like he kind of knew the language. You know, my dad, but he just may not have told me certain things, you know, or he just may, you know, for whatever reason. And, you know, those are some kind of the questions I always wish I could still ask him today, you know, but, you know, here we are today in 2023. And I look at the state of Washington is getting ready to acknowledge and recognize one of our own, you know, with a statue in the state, you know, the Billy Frank Jr. statue. You know, that is going to represent not just the Nisqually tribe, that's going to represent the state of Washington, which is just going to be so, so unique after everything we've been through, you know? And so I think about it, it's that story, you know, of I'd say, Dad, how come, you know, I remember, this is one thing I always remember, you know, asking him and he'd say, well, your grandpa didn't want us to learn it because of the boarding schools, you know, getting his mouth washed out, getting his hair cut, getting teased. But I always like to go back to this, to think today where we are as Nisqually people, Indian people, but the Nisqually language being awakened after 100 years. Actually, we'll say 49 years because it was used in the Bolt case. You know, and so I think to where we are today, you know, our language will be spoken in the United States Capitol for the rest of our lives, our kids' lives, and their kids' lives. Because that language is going to be on the statue. We're going to have his Indian name on there. You know, and so for me, we'll have Don't Forget the Water on there as well in Lushootse. But I actually had a lunch with the artist yesterday and, you know, to think about where we're going on this project, you know, and one of the core things for me and my foundational pieces is definitely that language, you know, but it's also the, you know, Bolt decision, you know, the Treaty of Medicine Creek, government to government relationships, and also just the understanding of what co-management is, you know, and it's really trying to build a government today, you know, that's going to fit the needs, not just of 2023, but I really think the next 100 years, next 50 years, you know, I think of Bolt 100, I think I'll be 92 when Bolt 100 hits. And so I keep telling people, God damn it, I'm making it till then, you know, because it's like this story is just, you know, it's not even close to being over, you know, with the opportunity with this statue and the magnitude that, you know, it has to put, it has to bring that sense of pride back to our people, because we've already had folks wanting to make video movies about my dad. You know, they're wanting to do all these things now as we start kind of putting things together and the statue's kind of coming full circle. You know, and I hope, you know, 2025 that you guys can be in Washington, D.C. attending that with us when we, you know, have the huge party there, you know, because I think this is really something to celebrate, I think, for all of our, you know, Indian country, but also, you know, just good people out in the world right now. You know, people ask, the one question they ask me, well, what do you want? What do you want people to know about your dad? You know, and I said, well, you know, I guess people are going to ask, well, you know, why'd they make a statue of this little 5'7" Indian hit with gray hair, arrested over 50 times, you know, and, you know, our goal here is to get everybody, you know, whether they met my dad or not, to feel that Billy magic, you know, and it's being able to, you know, people ask, well, what's that Billy magic? And I said, whatever you want it to be. I said, if you knew my dad and you knew how big of a heart he has, but you also knew what he went through, and he was still able to look the other way and do what's right for the people, you know, and like not worry about petty, you know, jealous or bitterness, some of the petty stuff we deal with today, you know, and that's what the tough days, that's when I really look back to my dad and think about, sometimes I just laugh like, God, how the hell did he do this? But then I think about all the times of what he went through, you know, the beating, the arrest, the tear gas. Man, we haven't gone through any of that, you know, this generation. You know, and I think about it, it's like our daughter, she goes to school in Oakland, California, plays basketball. And so she's 20 years old now. It's so beautiful because watching her grow, it's literally so funny now because I don't even have to, she'll call and she'll talk herself through her problem. And I'm like just sitting there listening. And it was like my dad used to do to me. Because one of the things that he always liked to do was kind of slow me down a little bit with, you know, when I was in high school. And so we'd always go out on the water, my dad and I, and we'd take my buddies out with us after school or on a Friday, Saturday, the weekend. Well, you know, us, we're kids thinking that, you know, everything we do is most important. And so my dad liked to take me out to the mouth of the Nisqually River right about when the tide changed and get us stuck out there. And we would have to sit out there until the tide turned, you know, which could be 4 or 5 hours, right? And so for me, that was his way. It wasn't a way of like, all right, you're grounded. It was a way of like, we're going to go sit out at the mouth of my river there and you're going to listen. Wow. And so like thinking back to some of those stories, and I had an elder, we had a general council meeting in May, and I had an elder come up to me and she said, you know, Chairman, you know, how you doing? You know, she goes, I know, I see you're kind of getting beat up on social media. I said, it just comes with it. I said, whatever, you know. And she said, well, I had a dream about, and your dad came to me in the dream. And I, you know, I hear this stuff. I'm like, okay, you know. And she goes, no, she said, but he told me he wants you to keep going to that place on the river that you guys used to go to. Then I kind of stopped for a sec. I'm like, huh? Wait, what did you just say? Like, nobody ever knows about any place on the river, you know? And so it was kind of crazy. And then she started talking more and more and kind of talking about her dream. And I'm like, the mouth of the river is the first place I go when I'm on the river, you know? And so for me, that was, of course, where my dad would take and get me stuck all the time. And so, you know, it's just kind of these life lessons of ways we got to try to teach a whole nother generation of patience, you know, of community, of family, of kinship, and just everything we have as Indian people.
Perseverance, I would add into that equation.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, they talk a lot about, in the coastal universe, professional world, resiliency is a massive initiative and a big term. Everybody talks about coastal resilience. And I tell you, if you want to understand resilience, look closely at the Native American community on the American shoreline, and particularly the Nisqually tribe, to see what resilience is really all about and how to keep pushing forward for the betterment of your community and for the state and the coastal resources. Willie, it's a tremendous legacy and a triumph of American history for you and your tribe and others, not only the Nisqually tribe, but the tribes that are working so hard to contribute to better resource management. It's a real legacy to be proud of, and a real privilege to, an absolute privilege, Willie, to have you on the show to talk about this and introduce our audience around the country to the work that you and your father and your tribe have done. It's really tremendous. We want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you guys. I look at this as just the beginning of our relationship. You know, I'm just glad we ran into each other that, that night at the Land Trust event, because that was the first time we hosted an event out there that ended up, we weren't sure how it was going to go. And so for us, it kind of opened up a whole new way for us to tell our story, of bringing people out to the Culture Center and kind of giving people that experience, I think that's kind of our goal for the next part of our storytelling here.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is a story worth listening to and following. It is Willie Frank III. He is the chair of the Nisqually tribe and a great member of the conservation community up here in the Pacific Northwest. Willie, thank you so much for sharing your story with our listeners on the American Shoreline podcast. We sure appreciate it.
Going too far, never coming back again. Sell to be